From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. James Kaplan returns to the show this week. 5 years ago, he published Frank, The Voice, the first volume of his definitive biography of Frank Sinatra. Now James Kaplan has completed the task with Sinatra, The Chairman. I read the book. Did I like it? You bet your bippy, baby. James Kaplan, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, I am so happy to be here, I can't even begin to describe it.
Well, congratulations on completing this task and doing it so well.
Thank you.
The period that you cover in this second volume is almost exactly the second half of his life, and I guess it's the period in which he had his greatest impact and influence as a singer.
I think so, although arguably during World War II, he... As a young ballad singer, he did have a huge impact, and when the whole country was longing for the boys who were away fighting, Sinatra really created the soundtrack to express everybody's longing and sadness then. But you're right. I just think there was an upsurge, a huge uptick in power once he won the Oscar for From Here to Eternity.
And also the audience for Sinatra changed slightly. That is, when you mentioned World War II, a lot of young men resented Sinatra for not serving. Whereas it's in this period in your second book, men like him maybe even more than women.
Yes. Well, women liked him a good bit, but you're right. As Sinatra matured, he put his draft dodger past behind him. He didn't lose all his public relations problems by any means, but with his new identity as America's swinger in chief, he made every man who was pushing a lawnmower and putting on a shirt and tie to go to the office every morning long to be like Frank.
He kind of created the uniform of the hipster that still exists to this day with that little hat and all that.
The little hat, skinny tie, skinny lapels, and the drinks.
And of course, the music. I mean, he does so many things: movies, concerts, television, and nightclubs, all that stuff. But records is really the main thing.
It really is the main thing, and it really was where his heart was. He loved to give a good concert, and in fact every recording session he did was a performance too, because there was always a gallery, and I've talked to numerous people who sat in on those recording sessions, and they really were performances. He, for the most part, he did movies. To him were the engine of his fame, and he kind of gave them the back of his hand. He was, as you know, a pathologically impatient man, and if you've ever been on a movie set, it's like watching paint dry. The cameras are on for 30 seconds, and then there's 25 minutes of moving lights and wires around, and it drove him nuts. He was so impatient, he couldn't stand it, and he became known as One Take Charlie, for good reasons and bad reasons. The good reason was that he knew that his most instinctive take was the first in the movies, and the bad reason was that most of the time he was dealing with directors who couldn't really control him and had to accept his one take. There were some exceptions, but in the movies. But in the recording studio, if it took 10, 15, 20, 22 takes, as it took on I've Got You Under My Skin, he would do it until he got it right. He knew that was his legacy.
Is it take 22 that we hear on Songs for Swingin' Lovers?
Songs for Swingin' Lovers, take 22, Milt Bernhardt blowing his lungs out, standing on a soda crate that Frank fetched for him because he needed to get up closer to the microphone to really make that that amazing trombone solo score.
Well, let's talk about him as an actor there for a second before we continue talking about recording. Would you say that he was better at one take because he's a natural actor, maybe lacked the training or the skills of an actor like Brando?
Yes, I would say that. I would say that he was a deeply insecure man, and one of the things he was insecure about was his acting ability. On the other hand, every performance, singing performance, was a form of passionate, deep and passionate acting. So he was an extremely instinctive actor, and yes, he was completely untrained. He liked to give out that he never took voice lessons, but he did take voice lessons in the 1940s from a former singer of the Metropolitan Opera, but he never took an acting lesson, and he had the presence to be able to bring it off.
Well, do you think if he'd studied with Steller Adler, he might have been a great actor?
Otto Preminger liked to say that had Sinatra devoted himself to acting, Billy Wilder concurred, that he would have been one of the greatest actors in the world. That's one of those subjunctive questions that can drive you nuts if you think about it too hard. He was what he was, and he put it into the singing.
Well, a lot of great singers are natural actors, I guess, because singing is a form of acting. I mean, Elvis Presley was a pretty good actor, and
he was a pretty good actor. Yeah,
Bing Crosby also a good actor.
Bing Crosby was an excellent actor.
Yeah,
yes.
And Judy Garland, Doris Day, those are very good actors.
You bet, they all were, and Sinatra was no exception. But he was really, really good when he respected the director, and that happened seldom. It happened with Fred Zinnemann on From Here to Eternity. It happened with Preminger on The Man with the Golden Arm, and it happened with the great John Frankenheimer on The Manchurian Candidate. And in between, there were a lot of poor schnooks who were Sinatra's doormat.
Did he have more respect in the studio for his conductors and arrangers? He worked, of course, with Nelson Riddle and Gordon Jenkins, Billy May.
Yes, he had the respect. He was the one who hired them. In the movies, it was sometimes the case, if Sinatra was producing the movie, that he would be responsible for hiring the director. But usually, it was the studio hiring the director. So it was a forced marriage. But Sinatra, there are nominal producers on every Sinatra album, but it is said widely of Frank that he had no producer. He was the producer. The producer was a guy who did his best to give some input and twirled some dials and gave some advice. There were exceptions to this, but when it came to arrangers, there's a story about Nelson Riddle, and there's a story about an aborted take of Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams not long after Sinatra began recording for Capitol. And Riddle had, they began a take, and Frank put his hand up, stopped the musicians, and took Riddle into the control booth. And the musicians remember just seeing, like that scene in 2001 when Hal is reading the astronaut's lips, the musicians remembered seeing, they couldn't hear what they were saying, but they saw Sinatra talking very vehemently to Nelson Riddle, who at the time was very young, and rather cowed by Sinatra. And what he was telling Riddle was that Riddle was a genius. He was a musical genius, and he was being, at that point, on Wrap Your Troubles and Dreams, he was being too much of a musical genius. He had written too many notes for Sinatra, and he was masking Sinatra's voice. And he learned a big lesson that day. And Sinatra could have dropped Nelson Riddle at that moment, but he knew. He knew with every, he had different feelings about every arranger he worked with, but he knew he loved each of them in different ways. With Gordon Jenkins, it was a much different case than it was with Nelson Riddle, but Sinatra loved him no less, even though the arrangements were much more sort of on the money, less complex, certainly not impressionistic textures and harmonies like Riddle wrote. Just very simple and very strongly emotional, and Sinatra loved them for being so emotional.
Yeah, if you listen to the Nelson Riddle arrangements, kind of listen underneath Sinatra's vocal, there's no melody. He doesn't play the melody in the arrangement.
The counterpoint is just so sublime.
Yeah, those records are so amazing, and there was so many of them. I mean, that was
so many
an amazingly productive period from 54 to 60 or whatever it was.
It was, and then Sinatra, to his credit, really, began branching out. He began tapping Jenkins and Billy May and Don Costa and Johnny Mandel. And poor Riddle, who felt quite rightly that he could write any style, and he could. He could write swinging numbers, he could write gorgeous ballads, he could write in the style of anybody. He was endlessly talented, but he took it so poorly. He was just so insulted by Sinatra's defecting and his treachery in hiring anybody else than Riddle. But Sinatra was right. He was right to do it. He got different sounds out of these different guys, and he got great albums out of other people. I'm crazy about Ring-a-Ding-Ding. Johnny Mandel did a wonderful job, and he's still with us today.
Life is dull, it's nothing but one big lull. Then presto, you do a skull and find that you're reeling. She sighs and you're feeling like a toy on a string. And your heart goes ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. How could that funny face that seemed to be commonplace project you right into space without any warning? Don't know if it's morning, nighttime, winter or spring. What's the difference? Ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. She takes your hand, this captivating creature, and like it's planned, you're in the phone book looking for the nearest preacher. Life is swell, you're off to that small hotel, and somewhere a village bell will sound in the steeple, announcing the people love's the loveliest thing. And the bell goes ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. Takes your hand, this captivating creature, and like it's planned, you're in the phone book looking for the nearest preacher. Life is swell, you're off to that small hotel, and somewhere a village bell will sound in the steeple, announcing the people love the loveliest thing. And the bell goes ring-a-ding-ding, 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 ring-a-ding-ding.
We're talking with James Kaplan, who's just completed his second volume on the life of Sinatra. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Ring-a-ding-ding, that was when Sinatra branched out into his own label and a new recording studio, a different sound.
Yes, all different, and there were some successes there at the beginning, but that label very quickly went downhill. It very quickly went downhill because Sinatra, great as a singer as he was he was certainly not a record executive. He hired a young accountant to lead Reprise Records, his new label, a young man named Mo Austin, who is also still with us and whom I interviewed at great length. And I think that Austin at first was intimidated by Sinatra. And Sinatra was very determined to hire all his friends, people like Dean Martin and Dinah Shore and even Bing. He had this thing called the Reprise Repertory Theater, where he had people of his ilk, singers he knew and loved, sang songs from Broadway shows, and they didn't sell. They didn't sell records. And it wasn't until this miraculous thing happened, which was that Jack Warner of Warner Brothers got it into his head he had to have Sinatra as a movie actor, and Sinatra had this very sly lawyer named Mickey Rudin, and Rudin, I won't say hoodwinked, but I think he pressured Jack Warner into taking the record label along with Sinatra, the movie star, and it became Reprise became Warner Reprise, and Mo Austin, lo and behold, began signing rock and roll artists. He signed the Kinks, and suddenly Warner Reprise and Reprise, because they operated together and separately, suddenly they started selling a lot of records. So that turned around, but in the beginning it was rough going.
That rock and roll, it's largely sung by degenerates, and
it is yes.
As Frank famously said at some point.
Yes.
You know, the interesting thing about Sinatra, I mean, there are so many interesting things, but one of the interesting things, and you brought it out so well in your book, is that you've got a guy who won the Gene Herschelt Humanitarian Award, which he richly deserved,
yes,
and at the same time could really be a huge prick.
He really could be. Pete Hamill, who knew him in his later years, said very sweetly and understatedly, his shortcomings were regrettable. And they were, and his shortcomings were many. He was a deeply insecure man. He was a volcanically angry man. And his anger was very often, most often, I think, fueled by alcohol. He began drinking during the Ava years when she was giving him so much trouble, and then when she left him for a bullfighter and stayed away for good. And he upped the intake over the years. He would drink a fifth of Jack Daniels every day, along with his three packs of unfiltered Camels. And he was an angry drunk. He was a mean drunk. It brought out his demons. And as the power grew and the sense of entitlement grew and everybody around him was jumping at his every whim, it created a very toxic mixture a lot of the time. I say that I worked on these two volumes for 10 years, and he was a genius in several ways. He was a genius, and certainly a musical genius of Mozartian capabilities, but he was a genius at being dislikable, and I very frequently disliked Sinatra, but I never felt contempt for him. There's a fine line, but I mean that. I never felt contempt for him. I disliked him a lot of the time. I was never bored with him.
A man of contradictions, absolutely.
Yeah.
And did he have a short attention span? I mean, he would do lots of things, including, I mean, obviously singing and movies and the things we talked about, but he also was an orchestra conductor, a film director.
Well, he was a brilliant man. He was a brilliant man. Unlike Dean Martin, who dropped out of high school at about the same age Sinatra did, Frank was an autodidact, and so did he have a short attention span? Well, when you asked that, I immediately thought of From Here to Eternity. That book, that novel, that doorstop of a novel, came out in 1951, and Sinatra got it, and he began reading it, completely fascinated with it. That is an 800 or 900-page novel, and he immediately saw it, was immediately captured, enthralled by the character of Maggio, and felt it was him. When it mattered to him, when he was invested, his attention could be focused like a laser. When he got bored, it was Splitsville.
Never looked back.
Never looked back.
Yeah. And how did he feel about, you know, he held a grudge, yes?
You put it so mildly.
Yeah.
Yes, he had that. He was, his mother was a Genovese from northern Italy, Genoa, and his father was born in Sicily. And even though Sinatra Frank was, Frank and his mother Dolly were really in many ways the same person, he did inherit that Sicilian streak of that fondness for vendetta from his father's his father's roots, and yes, once crossed, he never forgave, or very rarely forgave. And there were several several people along the way who he would just, he had been very close to. He would just drop them, cut them off, and that was that. That was very much that way with poor Lauren Bacall, who hadn't done anything, but say yes to marrying him. And then this horrible thing happened that, since Frank couldn't abide intimacy, he proposed to Lauren Bacall with a mutual friend named Swifty Lazar present, this blabbermouth literary agent who went and yapped to Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper that that Frank had proposed to Bacall. It got into the gossip columns before Frank knew about it, and he was furious. And from that day, he never spoke to Bacall again. And I once interviewed Bacall, and she said it was awful. She said she would encounter Frank at parties, and he would just walk by looking through her as if she didn't exist.
Of all the despicable things he does, that's like the most despicable one.
It really is.
And, I mean, of course, he was married to Mia Farrow, and then when he decided not to be married to her anymore, he had his lawyer bring her divorce papers while she was
married. Well, she committed the cardinal sin for a Sinatra wife, which was that she wanted to have a career. It happened with Juliet Prowse, whom he almost married, and it certainly happened with Ava Gardner, whose career was on the upswing as Sinatra's was on the downswing in the early 50s. And he met Mia Farrow when she was 19, and he was, or even earlier actually, but when she was a teenager, and he was rapidly approaching 50, and there were many qualities in Mia Farrow that he admired deeply, not the least of which was her sexuality. She used to say that her measurements were 20-20-20, but that wasn't true. She was a sexy young woman. She was also a highly intelligent and sensitive, deeply sensitive young woman, very articulate. I think he was really in love with her, but she was also enormously ambitious, and she was actively looking for movie roles at a time when Frank wanted her to stop working. And then she did that movie Rosemary's Baby when she was very bad, very naughty. She was supposed to be reporting to work on Sinatra's movie The Detective, and so he fired her as a wife.
Let me ask you about his last wife, Barbara Marx. You're not a fan of hers.
I'm not. When they got married, Sinatra was nearing the end of his career as a Lothario, and they were both looking for something. He was looking for somebody to take care of him and to take care of things. And she was looking for the ultimate brass ring. She traded up, after all, from Zeppo Marx to Frank Sinatra. This was a Palm Springs lady who, by all accounts, was extremely sunny. She was athletically talented. She was the perfect Palm Springs woman. She was blonde. She could play tennis. She could play golf. She was cheerful. She could host a dinner party. She was not particularly deep. She was not a reader or a thinker. She was a doer. She loved, she's still with us. I'm sure she still does. She loved and loves good things. Frank bought her a lot of jewelry. Some of the musicians I talked to said that when they toured with Sinatra overseas, that Mrs. Sinatra, first thing whenever they arrived at a new city, new hotel, she would make a beeline for the jewelry store. It was part of the deal. But calling it an arrangement is a very cold way of putting it. But they both each needed something from the other. He needed somebody to take care of him. She wanted to be the ultimate Palm Springs wife, and being Mrs. Frank Sinatra was that. And they both got something out of it. And I do think that at the beginning there certainly was sexual attraction and some affection. I think that changed over the years, and it became more of an arrangement. Tina Sinatra is extremely scathing about Barbara Sinatra, although she certainly has a dog in that hunt, because the legacy, the inheritance, was a matter of contention between Barbara and the Sinatra children. Of the four wives, yes, I can certainly say that the first three were more interesting and likable to me than the fourth.
We're talking with James Kaplan, who's just published Sinatra, The Chairman. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Your book kind of sort of ends with Frank Sinatra's retirement, his short-lived retirement, and you use the remainder of the 25 years of Frank's life as kind of a epilogue.
A coda, yes. Yeah. Musical coda, yeah.
What about L.A. Is My Lady or The First Deadly Sin? Those were some pretty... He did some pretty great things in that last part of his life.
Well, and I've certainly been accused by passionate Sinatra fans of giving extremely short shrift to the last part of his life. But I felt... I felt that his life had changed so radically after he came back from the retirement. He was not really making movies anymore. A contract on Cherry Street and First Deadly Sin aside, not really a movie star anymore, and not making many albums anymore. He was in a big way. He was kind of ahead of his time. The musicians today don't really make money off records anymore. That you have to make money from touring, and that's what Sinatra decided to do. He became purely a concert artist. Once Sinatra was no longer the lover of hundreds, if not thousands, of women, once he was making far fewer record albums and far fewer movies, and doing essentially the same thing again and again, doing these concerts, however great some of them were, and the one Sinatra concert I went to was Carnegie Hall in 1981, 10 years after the retirement, and he was staggeringly great. It just became, for me, less of a narrative. And again, there are those who disagree with me, but I, as a biographer, derived such pleasure out of the early part of his life, the rise of the romantic young troubadour, and then once his comeback started at the beginning of Volume 2, the acquisition of incredible worldly power. That was all very interesting to me. The life after the comeback from retirement in 1973 was simply less dimensional to me. There are certainly, as you say, there are projects worthy of mention, and but it wasn't the same life for me after 1973.
Now, I saw him in several times, but including 1981. That was a banner year for him. He did some great shows in 81. And I remember you saying in your book that since he left the showroom of Nevada, that his concerts were less intimate. And granted, there were more people there. But when I saw him, the very first time I saw him at the Circle Star Theater in San Carlos, that theater was in the round. And although it held more people than a Las Vegas showroom, because it was in the round, it was still very intimate because you were pretty close to the stage.
And he did have that amazing gift of making everybody in the room, no matter the size of the room, feel that he was singing to them and them alone. You're right. There is certainly a point to be made. But in order to make money... In order to make money, he had to go to venues that were larger and larger, and I just found a certain, a certain incongruity between his self-definition as a saloon singer and his performing in these big concerts, big concert after big concert. I hear what you're saying, and certainly. When I saw him at Carnegie Hall in 81, don't ask me how, but I managed to score a front row seat.
Hmm.
I felt that he was right there in front of me. It was an amazing thing. But I've spoken to many people who saw him play the Sands and saw him, even people who saw him play the Copa in New York, and it was different. Or the 500 Club in Atlantic City, these small, very smoky rooms.
In San Carlos, the late show started at 10, not 5.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is watching him come into a room, a showroom at 5 a.m., with a freshly pressed tuxedo, that must have been That must have been something.
That must have been something, yes, exactly, yes. Las Vegas blue, that was the color of the sky between just at twilight at the other side, on the other side of the night.
Well, this is an amazing book, James Kaplan. How did you do it? There's so much that you had to weave together. How did you manage to do it?
Well, in certain ways I cannot answer that, but all I can tell you is that I was just trying to tell a story. I'm always trying to do that. The first book is different from the second book. The first book is more novelistic, I think, and some people felt that certain imaginative and narrative liberties were taken in the first book, although what I always tell people is that I researched every scene that I dressed in that first book, every scene I tried to bring to life, I researched very, very deeply. The second book is a different style. It's a tougher, darker book because it's about a tougher, darker subject matter. And yet, it's always important to me. My training, my background is as a fiction writer. I'm still a novelist. And I always want to tell the story. I was aware in every chapter I was writing that this is a narrative that must be propelled, that the reader's interest must be held, and mine, first of all. I'm the reader as well as the writer, and I want to tell a story above all things, and I like to think that I brought it off.
Well, I think you did. Congratulations again. It's a fabulous book. It's called Sinatra, the Chairman, and the author, James Kaplan. Thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's my great pleasure, Gary. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, James Kaplan, his latest book, Sinatra, the Chairman. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.